Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. As we near the end of 2003, which marks the 200th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase, we thought we would devote one more program to the greatest land deal in American history. This time we'll be looking at it from the perspective of how the acquisition matched up with President Thomas Jefferson's vision of America and his views on farming and slavery. I'll be speaking with historian Roger Kennedy on that subject. And then in our commentary of the week, James Banner will offer us his thoughts on the immediate and long-term effects of the Louisiana Purchase on the nation. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at another important event that occurred this week in history.
On this day in history, December 2, 1942, a coded telephone message, "The Italian navigator has just landed in the New World," confirmed the first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. The dawn of the atomic age took place at 3:25 p.m. under the grandstands at the University of Chicago's Stagg Field. Enrico Fermi headed the team that successfully created nuclear energy. Fermi, a recipient of the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1938, defected to the United States from fascist-ruled Italy, initially working at Columbia University. Later, Fermi met Niels Bohr at a physics conference, and the pair exchanged news on the research of other nuclear scientists, especially in Germany, and the hypothesis that splitting the nucleus of uranium-235 would release enormous amounts of energy. Realizing the significance of this, Fermi and other scientists asked Albert Einstein to write to President Franklin Roosevelt requesting that atomic research receive top priority. Roosevelt agreed. The project began in Chicago, but work later shifted to New Mexico, where a team of scientists under the supervision of J. Robert Oppenheimer developed the atomic bomb.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a 351-year-old coin, one of the first ever minted in colonial America, has been found in Britain. The rare New England silver sixpence turned up when relatives of a deceased British man were rummaging through his belongings. They sent it to an expert for identification and were told that it's one of only 9 New England silver sixpences known to exist, all minted in Boston in 1652. The coin is about the size of a penny, with NE for New England stamped on one side. The Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence are available for public viewing once again, and for the first time all 4 pages of the Constitution, rather than just the first and last, are on display. The documents were removed from public view in July 2001 and treated to ensure their longevity while the National Archives was undergoing renovation. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
As the year draws to an end, we once again mark the 200th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase, this time in conversation with Roger Kennedy, the author of Mr. Jefferson's Lost Cause, Land, Farmers, Slavery, and the Louisiana Purchase. Mr. Kennedy, who joins us from his home in Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Director Emeritus of the National Museum of American History of the Smithsonian Institution and the author of several other books, including Burr, Hamilton, and Jefferson. He also served as Director of the National Park Service during the 1990s. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you.
Let me start by asking you to explain the following lines in the introduction to your book, which I think alert the reader to the focus of your book and will alert our listeners to the subject of our conversation. You wrote, "The Louisiana Purchase is the central event in this story. Thomas Jefferson is its central character."
Well, the central event is the moving of the Mississippi River from the margin of the American Republic to its center fold, the doubling of its territory, of course. The central figure is that person who happened to be president at the time that Napoleon abandoned his dream of a renewed French New World Empire and offered the rather undelineated Louisiana to the United States.
Okay, so we're looking at Jefferson in the context of that purchase. So let's talk about Jefferson as your central character, and we'll take him on first. You write that Jefferson's stated aspirations, his vision for America, what was that vision?
Jefferson said throughout his life that he dreamed of a republic of free and independent farmers, a little bit of domestic manufacturing around the side, but dreamed of such a republic without slavery. And so he said repeatedly. That was Mr. Jefferson's lost cause.
You say stated, though. Are you suggesting that he was not really committed to this?
No, I think it's more subtle than that. I don't believe that we historians or citizens can enter into the mind and heart of someone long departed. All we can do when we write history is to take what someone says, observe their actions, and then see whether or not we think it's likely that they meant what they said. It is my opinion that Mr. Jefferson did mean what he said, and that his life was, as a consequence, a bitter disappointment.
I want to pursue that one, but first let's get our central event into the story here, the Louisiana Purchase. And for those of our listeners who didn't catch earlier shows, give us a little background on how the purchase came to pass.
Napoleon had attempted to, through an enormous army he sent under the command of his brother-in-law, to capture the prize of the New World at that time, which was the island of Haiti, the greatest sugar-producing area in the world, more important at that time than India was to the French or the British. That failure was brought about by Toussaint Louverture and his largely but not completely black government. The defeat of that expedition rendered Louisiana, meaning the mainland, no longer useful as the primary supply source, primarily of hides and draft animals and wheat, to keep the sugar plantations going. So when Toussaint's heroic resistance to that Napoleonic endeavor was successful, Napoleon and Talleyrand, serving for him as his foreign minister, concluded that they would get rid of their claim on Louisiana, which, of course, they didn't own and actually weren't in possession of either. The Spanish were still there. And all that happened actually was that Napoleon had extricated under coercion a promise from Spain to turn over Louisiana in return for a promise that if Spain turned over Louisiana, they would never turn it over in turn to the United States. Napoleon's success was in getting the United States to pay for Louisiana, which France then occupied in the twinkling of an eye, less than a 2.5 month period, and the United States purchased the Napoleonic claim on Louisiana for an immense sum of money. That's what That's what happened. We got, however, a third of a continent, which we're very glad to have.
Okay, we got a third of a continent, so let's bring the character and the event together, and let's ask, how did this purchase of a third of a continent impact Jefferson's vision?
Jefferson was presented with a third opportunity to achieve a society without slavery. The first opportunity, east of the Appalachians, during the Revolutionary War, we did abolish slavery in half the states of the Union, though not in Virginia and the South. Second opportunity, between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River, we, in many, many instances, had only barely permitted slavery to expand south of the Ohio, where it wasn't, of course, at all established when we achieved our independence. Louisiana was the third great opportunity. There was very little slavery in Louisiana when we bought it, and in fact, most scholars agree that slavery was withering up in Louisiana when we bought it. Had we put a little more pressure on its withering, and had the Congress been successful, as it nearly was on three occasions, in stopping the spread of slavery into Louisiana, but just a little extra exertion had occurred, we might very well have never had a civil war, because we wouldn't have had the problem of the expansion of slavery into the territories purchased.
Okay, I want to come back to that issue of slavery, but first clarify another thing. In your book, you make reference to the Invisible Empire. What was the Invisible Empire?
That's the British Empire operating no longer as an ostensible imperial power with armies and navies and viceroys, but instead a commercial empire bent upon the recolonialization of the American South as a source of cotton for the British mills. The British had an enormous effect upon American politics after we became independent politically, but after the South remained dependent economically. The Invisible Empire exerted such enormous gravitational force upon Mr. Jefferson's career and presidency that Britain got a predictable, dependable source of slave-produced cotton out of the deal. They were the big winners.
Were we the big losers? By that I simply mean, unlike most accounts, which clearly just sing the praises of the purchase and say this is the greatest thing that ever happened to the United States, your assessment is a little more tempered than that. Where do you fall in that scheme?
Thank you. That's a well-modulated inquiry. The opportunity, of course, to achieve an empire of freedom, which is what Jefferson said that he wanted, the opportunity is a dazzling one, to have a continent free of slavery would have been something never seen before in human affairs. It would have been simply dazzling. As it was, we acquired an enormous piece of real estate for which we are grateful, in which many of us were born, but we also inherited the curse of slavery upon it, and inherent in that curse of slavery was the irrepressible conflict between slavery and freedom, which cost us millions of lives in the Civil War.
Now, it's interesting if we add to that another issue that comes up, especially in shorter accounts or textbook accounts of the Louisiana Purchase, and that is most of the more general histories imply that one way or another, our taking the territory we would call the Louisiana Territory was inevitable. Do you see that as the case, or was it actually a possibility that we might not have had that territory?
Oh, I think almost nothing's inevitable in history. Certainly, the battening of slavery upon Louisiana territories was not inevitable. It's entirely possible that Spain, which had had a resurgence of vitality in the 1780s and 90s, might have been able to hold on to Louisiana, that enormous territory, at least until the American Republic had filled in some more. It seems to me, if we're doing sort of hypothetical outcomes, that the triumphant result resumption of British imperial power, which came enormously quickly after 1783. After all, they received a defeat, which we call the American Revolution, which was a world war in 1783. By 1815, they were Britain triumphant. The great power in the world was the British. And it opens an enormously interesting question if the Canadian border had proceeded down the Mississippi, so to speak.
Would you care to pursue that just a moment? What do you think would have happened if that scenario had spun out? Or don't you have a crystal ball that you can look
well,
into?
Well, it's fun to play. It's a kind of a computer game, isn't it?
It is.
What would it be like? Well, that would lead us into, it seems to me, very useful speculations as to the essential distinctions between Canadian society and that of the United States. One thing we can be sure of is that there would not have been slavery in the Louisiana Territory had that outcome occurred. I don't want to suggest for a moment that as a person who was born out there, whose life has been largely spent in the territory acquired, that I wish it were in any way Canadian. I simply think it's very important for us to understand that there are two European-based great democracies operating in North America, and one of them is different from the other.
Okay, interesting for history's sake. Let me ask you another question, and let's return to Jefferson, because this inevitably comes up. Much ink has been spilled on Jefferson and his views, especially on slavery, but even on the land. Going back to the writing of the Declaration of Independence and holding him up as a founding father of democracy. At some point, the Jeffersons repeatedly compromising. You alluded to it earlier with the three lost opportunities. Where do you stand in terms of Jefferson and slavery? How would you explain his behavior, his attitude towards slavery?
Oh, I've been in and around public life since 1948, which is rather a long time. And I've watched some very great figures, including the four cabinet officers I've worked for at one time or another, and six presidents one way or another. Many of the things we strive to achieve, we do not succeed in achieving. Many times we are overwhelmed in our lives by forces larger than those that we can control. I think that's the story of Thomas Jefferson. I think it's useless and maybe a little bit silly to use words like hypocrisy. Hypocrisy implies an intention to do something different than that which we state is an objective. And I just don't think that's a useful inquiry to pursue. I think what happened to Jefferson is that he simply did not have, as his best friend, Mr. Madison, said, he was not a person made for heroism. He was a person made for politics, for accommodation, and for yielding when the people that mattered most to him wished him to yield, and the people who mattered most to him were the planters of Virginia. I just don't think, and most of the people who knew him didn't think, that Jefferson was a person, shall we say, of Lincoln's qualities. He was not, or Washington's.
Well, you may have the last word here on the Louisiana Purchase. This is the last show we're going to do this year on the 200th anniversary. So let me ask you to sum up things you've been hinting at here, including in your last answer here. What's Jefferson's legacy? What's this lost cause you write about? And how does it relate to the Louisiana Purchase?
Any person who undertakes public life does so because they have a set of things they'd like to achieve. To think otherwise is to have a very reduced view of why people enter public life. In Jefferson's case, he stated very consistently and purposefully over his entire lifetime that he wished to achieve a republic of free and independent farmers. That's not what his beloved Southland got. And the purchase of Louisiana battened slavery upon the South even more profoundly and expanded it into the American West. That is, in my view, a tragic story.
And that's where we'll have to end it. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Please join us again soon.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Roger Kennedy, the author of Mr. Jefferson's Lost Cause, Land, Farmers, Slavery, and the Louisiana Purchase, published by Oxford University Press. This is Talking History. For our commentary of the week, we continue on the subject of the Louisiana Purchase and get another view of the land deal, this time by James Banner, an independent historian who lives in Washington, D.C. and is the co-director of the History News Service.
Not since the ages of the Spanish and British empires has a nation so bestrode the world as the United States does today. The collapse of the Soviet system, the superiority of American arms, and the strength of the American economy have created a new American imperium. But empires, like trees, have many roots, some of them ancient and deep. And the taproot of American worldwide dominance sprouted 2 centuries ago this year, when the administration of Thomas Jefferson sealed with France the agreement that set the United States on its way to becoming a continental nation. Rarely has that extraordinary act had as much resonance as it does today. As so often has been the case, European distress bred American opportunity. Napoleon's France needed cash for its Marshall ventures on the continent, and its vast but unsettled domains in the North American West, including New Orleans, could no longer be defended against encroaching American settlers. Skillfully negotiating with their French counterparts, Jefferson's emissaries in Paris, Robert Livingston and James Monroe, shook the huge, ripe Louisiana plum off its French tree. Then, faced with such an extraordinary boon, Jefferson overcame his constitutional scruples and agreed to the deal, $15 million for much of what would become the great interior territory of the United States. An empire for liberty, he called it. Rarely has such fruit been harvested so easily and cheaply. No war, no conquest, little debt. And rarely has such fruit brought in its train so many allied legacies, those with which we live today. The benefits of the purchase were recognized immediately and realized quickly. The size of the infant republic, already in 1803 the largest in the world, doubled with a few pen strokes in the exchange of modest funds. The U.S. became a continental nation, reaching from sea to sea. Its greatly augmented size was enough to make the United States a force to reckon with only a quarter century after it had gained its independence. But the huge territory that fell to the United States was not just the symbol of future strength. Those acres were to yield agricultural and mineral bounty beyond the dreams of men. The roots of American economic might, planted earlier, suddenly reached deep and far. Yet with bounty came aspiration and responsibility, both deeply stained. The spread of European settlements set in motion the extermination of the Indian tribes, and the new lands to the west released slavery to travel beyond the national boundaries of the Mississippi River set by the treaty that had ended the American Revolution. More to the point today, the purchase vastly strengthened an American disposition to claim for itself what it wished to and gave it the muscle to do so. In the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, the United States served notice that the entire Western Hemisphere was off limits to further foreign settlement and under a kind of American protectorate. By the late 1840s, war had taken from Mexico the additionally huge territories of Texas, the Southwest, and California. By then, Americans are speaking of their manifest destiny to bestride the entire continent, and then some. The Louisiana Purchase commenced a century of expansion that would extend American territory eventually to Hawaii. If Jefferson's Declaration of Independence gave Americans a noble and enduring way to think of themselves, the Louisiana Purchase encouraged them to realize that self-image in lesser, sometimes baser forms. An empire, whether bought of armies, religion, or ideology, always carries with it harm to others and the seeds of its own end. Upon signing the treaty that gave the United States its imperial reach, Robert Livingston remarked that from this day the United States takes their place among the powers of the first rank. Already, 200 years ago, a whiff of presumptuousness was in the air.
You've been listening to James Banner, co-director of the History News Service and one of the moving forces behind an effort to establish a National History Center. And finally, we turn to our site of the week and call to your attention a new national museum. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
A new national museum honoring the Constitution has opened in Philadelphia, and some say the timing could not be better. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor officiated at the opening of the $185 million National Constitution Center, which is situated only three blocks from Independence Hall. The museum was conceived more than a decade ago and took 3 years to build, and it opens at a time, some have commented, of heightened patriotism following the September 11, 2001 attacks. That is the challenge that the framers faced, the challenge of balancing liberty with security, and it is a challenge that has echoed down through the ages, said Stephen Frank, the center's director of research, at the opening. The museum embraces 216 years of constitutional controversy, from Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial to Watergate, and includes items such as petitions to Congress calling for the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, and protection of the rights of Native Americans. Next time you're in the City of Brotherly Love, stop by the National Constitution Center in Independence Mall.
And that wraps up another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. If you'd like to learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.